From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in February 2019 when Buffalo Mayor Byron Brown declared that Buffalo is a climate refuge city. Buffalo, like Rochester, Duluth, Minnesota, and other cities that don't really experience all that much extreme weather, are on the map as destinations for climate migrants, people escaping really the vagaries of climate extreme weather, hurricanes, wildfires, droughts, and more. And several weeks ago, you know, I was just thinking about what was going on in Texas. You're watching, you know, frankly, the amazement that people feel in watching Texans without power by the tens of thousands, frozen, you know, sort of out of their homes and snow and not really having a grid or an infrastructure to deal with this. We saw tornadoes in snow-ravaged places. I mean, it's just stuff that you don't think about often. And all I was thinking was, man, that's not us. Here's what I wrote. I wrote, here's something that would surprise many Americans. Rochester is one of the most reliable places to live if you want to avoid extreme weather. No hurricanes, no drought, fresh water. Yes, snow, but always manageable. And it's hard to watch the country struggle with extremes. You never know what's going to really spark engagement. And wow, hundreds upon hundreds of people sharing that, commenting, weighing in from different parts of the country about what they're experiencing, thinking about, is this a place that I want to live long term? Am I comfortable with extreme weather wherever you are? And maybe you think Rochester does have extreme weather. I kind of don't, but feel free to correct me here. But we're talking about Rochester as a possible destination. And let's bring in our guests now. Karen Berger is a professor of instruction in earth and environmental sciences at the University of Rochester. Professor Berger, welcome back. It's great to have you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Brady Ferguson is director of public engagement for the Climate Solutions Accelerator of the Genesee Finger Lakes region and member of Rochester's chapter of the Climate Citizen, the Citizens Climate Lobby, CCL. Brady, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Evan. Great to be here.
I want to ask both of you, just for starters, you know, just kind of let me know if you think I'm off base in what I was sort of observing. And I wasn't, you know, sort of throwing a tweet out there to kind of be, you know, like kind of like a troll or anything. I'm not trying to exert any sort of boast or anything like that. And I certainly don't want people to be hurting when they're down. I mean, I've got an aunt who lives in Houston, and you know, she lost all of, you know, her outside vegetation and things that she'd been working on for years. And that was somebody who lost very little compared to what others in Texas lost. Some people lost their lives. And I'm watching this, Professor Berger, thinking, you know, for all of the knocks Rochester takes about being a snow city, like, so what? I mean, we have fresh water and we just don't have extremes, at least not right now. How do you feel about that, Professor?
I have to say that I agree with you. It's something I've been saying since I moved to Rochester from Southern California, how nice it is to be somewhere where there's natural greenery. We have the Great Lakes nearby. We don't have excessive heat. You know, we do have our challenges in the winter, but I think you're right. It is really a place where we're fortunate to live, that the challenges we get are ones that we are, for the most part, able to handle.
When did you move from California?
I moved in 2000, so pre-wildfires and all that, but definitely already a time of severe drought and the fears about earthquakes.
What do your friends and colleagues and family who are elsewhere, especially California, what comes to mind when they think, oh, you're moving to Rochester? What did they say then? What do they say now?
When we moved here, they all said, oh, you'll be back. Nobody can handle the snow in Rochester. but, you know, frankly, between having enough water and not having the traffic, I think there's a little bit of jealousy that they've got now sometimes too.
You'll be back, they said. And then that is so interesting. Brady Ferguson, how do you feel about, you know, just looking at Rochester? And I say Rochester, it's the Finger Lakes region, it's Western New York, in this context of extreme weather.
Well, Evan, I think you were right on the money with your comments there about this being a great place to live as far as not having to worry about that extreme weather. I'll say I'm born and raised Rochesterian, so it's always home for me just because I was born here and grew up here. But still, I've lived in different places, including Southern California, also including South Florida, including small island in the Central Pacific Ocean. So I've lived in a number of different places, but for the weather being one of the main reasons and the lack of extreme weather, that's just one reason that makes Rochester a pretty good place to be living, especially when we look at what's going on in the news now with just these extreme weather events that just seem to be coming up so much more frequently now.
Listeners, if you want to weigh in on this, I'm curious to know, you know, if you're from this region originally and if you thought, you know, I can't wait to get out. A lot of people growing up, they always think that I'm going to travel, I'll never come back. But maybe as you got older, you thought, no, this is pretty good. I'm pretty happy here. Or maybe you've moved here from elsewhere, like Professor Berger mentioned, and our guests have just talked about. And maybe your views on this region are very different compared to what a national reputation might be. I would love to hear from you. You can email the program connections@wxxi.org. Or you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And again, the email is connections@wxxi.org. So there's a lot of threads that I want to follow here, because apart from just talking about extreme weather, which I think is very interesting given this region's reputation versus the reality, there's the question of infrastructure. There's the question of, you know, what's actually feasible. And I mentioned at the outset that, you know, the New York Times reported on Buffalo, New York, Duluth, Minnesota, already trying to position themselves as places that more Americans should be thinking about moving and living just because of changes in climate. Now, I want to think about if that is sort of a feasible future. And that doesn't mean everybody would move overnight here because the weather doesn't change overnight. I mean, I guess we should start there, Professor Berger. When we think about ongoing crises, Donald McNeil, the former New York Times reporter, was just writing about how, in his view, at least this is a slow-rolling disaster in which people who live on coastlines will, you know, ideally, if they've got means, have time to move away. And if we are a compassionate society, we will figure out how to help those who don't have means to move, because we're going to have to do it. Maybe we move, you know, coastline cities to higher ground. Maybe we move people near, you know, ocean fronts to different places, and it happens over time. It doesn't happen in 2021 or 2024 or 2026. And it's the kind of thing where you see a population trend like ours reverse slowly. Probably not something that happens quickly. Is that right, Professor Berger?
Yes, I expect that you're right. We'll see births after things like Hurricane Maria, where you might have an extra large number of people who come at a particular time. But really, with the way to minimize the negative impacts is to do this gradually, so that when we're building up the infrastructure, we can plan proactively and build it out over time, rather than needing to have more housing, have more public transportation, have more water management overnight. So I think you're right that ideally it will happen over time.
And that's looking at a population change. I mean, we're not going to go from a city of 200,000 to 350 in a year, barring something truly catastrophic. Not to say a hurricane's not catastrophic, but I think people understand the point. But does that minimize this disaster, Professor? In other words, is there a danger to downplaying it, saying, well, at least we got time to get people to higher ground here, when we're actually talking about massive changes in infrastructure and where people live, and some cities eventually being maybe even being unlivable in the future?
Yeah, I think those are really the questions that need to be happening in places like Houston and New Orleans and other coastal areas that are seeing these repeated disasters, taking the time to reflect about the extent to which things can be done differently in small degrees versus the extent to which they need to be really overhauled and thought. I was reading a book recently about looking at New Orleans after Katrina, and how there was the thought that certain neighborhoods really should not exist where they are. But nobody wants to say that. It's politically and socially very difficult to say that. So within that context, how do you move forward to be having those conversations about what changes need to happen?
Well,
before that area.
Before I get Brady on this, let me just sneak in a phone call from Karen in Pittsford, who sounds like you're surprised that people don't think that this weather here is extreme. Is that right, Karen?
Yes, that's right. I'm driving. I hope you can hear me okay. My Bluetooth isn't working.
I can hear you. Just be safe.
Okay. I moved here from Southwest Florida, where the sky is blue every day and the sun shines every day, and I love Rochester. But my first winter here, I was thinking, wow, like, how did people decide to settle in this place? You know, like, it was so brutal and so harsh. And when the wind was shoving me, I was thinking, it's like God is telling me, go away, you know? So to me, for many, many weeks, every day is an extreme weather day in Rochester, New York. I get that we have a large supply of fresh water and that things are getting worse all over the world. And as I said, I love Rochester. But I was just astounded that you guys don't see this as an extreme weather place. Like, I couldn't believe it. That's all.
Okay. Can I ask you a quick question before I let you go, Karen?
Yes.
Have you adjusted? I mean, are you more used to colder days, or do you feel that the Southwest Florida is sort of deeply embedded in your soul?
No, I have totally adjusted. Mm. And my Floridian relatives always say, how can you stay up there? I moved in 2001, so I've been here a long time. And by the way, I'm not really a Karen. Having the name Karen is a curse these days. But anyway, my Floridian relatives and my friends who moved to Southwest Florida from a cold place because they wanted to get away from the cold can't understand that I'm fine with it. I have totally adjusted. They say, how do you go through all those winters? How do you go through the gray days? And I said, I'll just put one foot in front of the weather and in front of the other, and spring comes. So I have totally adjusted. However, because my family is there, that's where my heart is. And when I retire, I will move back there.
Interesting. Okay.
I don't think I would stay here the rest of my life. When I have seen people, I work on a college campus, you know, people in wheelchairs sliding up icy ramps and older people with walkers outside on the ice, I think, you know, like, I don't think anybody should live here if they are afraid of falling or anything. So I don't think I'd stay here forever, but I would not choose my hometown of Fort Myers either if I was going to move. And, you know, hurricanes are an issue. I'm used to sharks and alligators and poisonous snakes and hurricanes. Now, if it's a Cat 4 or Category 5, you evacuate early enough, you know. So it's whatever you get used to. But to me, this is an extreme weather place.
Well, Karen, thank you for the phone call. I appreciate it. We're glad you're here. And my brother is in Tampa, and he tries to torture me on 18-degree days by sending me pictures when it's 80 there, and it doesn't work. Sorry, Brother Ryan, but I'm very happy here. Now, interestingly enough, you know, Brady, I do think Karen's on the phone. Karen's point, that last point is actually one that we shouldn't overlook, in that she's thinking of people who are more vulnerable, people who maybe are less ambulatory, people with disabilities, and we certainly need to see better infrastructure, better public services to make sure everyone can live as comfortably as possible. Because it's one thing to say you're cold. It's another to say, you know, you're not very ambulatory and there's ice all the time and there's lack of removal or lack of sidewalk clearing. You know, the automobile dominates. And if you're not in an automobile, Brady, I think those points are good ones. What do you make of her phone call?
Yeah, point taken there. Extreme. When we say extreme, it is all relative. My best friend, who's from Rochester, he lives in Pensacola, Florida now. And a couple weeks ago, I sent him a picture of, or a little video of, my kids going sledding. And I was like, hey, sorry, you and your daughter don't get to be doing this. Because for me, this is like, this is great. Mm-hmm. Sorry, you're in Florida. You don't even get to do this. But his reaction was, whoa, that looks so cold, Brady, because he's lived in Florida for a few years now. And he thinks, and getting used to that climate, he thinks it'd be tough to come back here to the cold climate. So it is all relative, but still, I got to say, just kind of trying to look at a bigger picture. As far as extreme, some cold and some snow, I feel like that's less extreme than a hurricane. That's less extreme than dangerously hot days in the summer. And when we think of vulnerable populations, there are certainly vulnerable populations here, and cold and ice can make it more difficult. But I also think about people in Florida. And I remember when I lived in Florida in the summer, it was just like, honestly, from about April till November, it was just stay inside in the air conditioning all day.
Oppressive.
Most people really did not spend very much time outside. So for the people who can't afford that air conditioning, they're pretty vulnerable there too. And with these heat waves, especially in warmer climates now that are hitting in the summer, you have a lot more dangerously hot days during the summer. There are a lot of people that die from that. So to me, I look at that as more extreme than what we have here.
Yeah, and Professor Berger, before I jump back to phone calls, we're already lit up in the email inbox and the phone board, which is great, and we'll come back to that in a moment. But Professor Karen in Pittsford, I think, is half cheeky when she's making a point about the extreme cold. But if you're going to put your professorial hat on, I mean, we rarely see, well, once a winter, several times a winter, we see the kind of cold that can kill somebody, that can kill someone who does not have shelter or home, and that is serious. And we don't sort of joke about that or minimize that. But in terms of overall severe weather or extreme weather, how do you sort of compare that occasional burst of cold or 100 inches of snow versus the threat of Cat 4 and Cat 5 there?
I think you need to look at the magnitude of the risk and how able you are to protect against it. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of, yes, it's cold, it has a lot of threats. We have amazing services that clear the roads and clear many of the sidewalks. So there, we have the short-term challenges. You know, there's a certain point where there's nothing you can do against a Category 5 hurricane when it comes in terms of the impacts it's going to have. You know, there's no amount of sandbagging that can stop some of the storm surges. The other thing I wanted to point out that when I think about Rochester versus other places is that we have this recurrent short-term challenge of cold weather, and we have occasional heat waves that can have impacts. But I think when we're thinking about refugees from climate, we also need to think about the long-term challenges. It's not just the hurricanes, but it's the sea level rise. It is the extensive drought and risks of wildfires that are not something you can just respond to on the short term. And I think that's something that also is important to factor in when you're thinking about relative risks.
Yeah, and speaking of risk, Dave sends an email that says, with climate change, we should be preparing for more ice storms. Given our poor response to the ice storms in 1991 and 2003, we should temper our bragging about our lack of extreme weather. In Indiana, where I grew up, we had some funny-looking trees because they were trimmed for power lines. And Dave is saying, you know, that we're going to see more of that. And it's sort of a macabre exercise, Dave, but I do think that you're raising a fair point that over time, will we have more or fewer ice storms than the southern and eastern coastal states have hurricanes? I mean, that's not something anybody wants to think about. Right now we have, I think, fewer is fair to say, 2 in 30 years. But, you know, perhaps over time that will start to rival the number of hurricanes, and then it would be a real issue. I mean, it's always an issue when it happens. But I take that point, Dave, and I'm grateful for the email. Let me get back to your phone calls. This is, oh, boy, on line one. Is this Maine? Let's see here. Rob, is that the right number? Rob is laughing. Our engineer Rob is playing producer today. He's engineering, so I might have missed a letter, and it could be on the host. But who is it online in Rochester? Who do we have here? Can you hear me on line one? You're probably on the show now. Look at this live radio. This
I can hear you if you're asking for Maxine.
Yes, yeah, Maxine. Okay. I missed one letter. I missed the X.
The most important letter.
It is the most important letter. It's a beautiful one. Maxine in Rochester, I'm thrilled to have you. Thank you for being with us. Go ahead.
So I really appreciate it. I had the same thoughts about, I felt very lucky about being in Rochester as far as climate is concerned. And I realized that we're not near the coast and that we do have an abundant water supply. But two things concern me, and maybe it's my imagination, but it seems to me that we are having more severe winds than we used to have. Mm-hmm. And I'm also concerned about, you know, what else could happen. You know, everyone has been so surprised by the things that have happened to us. Are there things that, you know, we could foresee might not be so great?
It's a really good question, because sometimes we take this somewhat myopic or fixed view, as if what's happening in 2021 is relatively fixed and set. Brady, she's made a really good point about recent windstorms. We have seen really damaging windstorms, to say nothing of ice storms, but windstorms in recent years, significant power outages. I suspect there is some climate tie there. When you see serious fluctuations in weather, extreme changes that often comes with winds, and extreme swings is sometimes tied to long-term climatological change. Brady, how do you see that?
Yeah, well, I think probably everywhere in the world is going to see more extreme weather due to climate change. So that's not unique to Rochester or South Florida or anywhere in our country. I think that's just going to be worldwide. But I think looking at more of those long-term changes are what's more important than the just one single event, because a bad hurricane could hit and a lot of people evacuate their homes, but most of them, if not all of them, will try to go back to their homes. But when we see look at the long scale changes, like the sea level rise, like fires burning down complete communities and basically making them unlivable in the future, that's more what's going to cause people to move long term, to move permanently. And when I look at the news that I read, when I look at the numbers, it seems like Rochester and the other places you mentioned, Duluth, Minnesota, Buffalo, are more likely to be those destination cities for these people who are choosing to or being forced to move. And Professor Berger mentioned being proactive about it, but I think that's really key, because whether we want them to or not, people are going to move. When they can no longer live safely where their home was, people are going to move. They're not going to sit there and live in a flooded home. So whether we want them to or not, people are going to move. And the best thing we can do is to be proactive and get a plan ready for this so that it can happen in a more orderly, more fashion, which will work better both for the people already here and for the people who will be moving here.
Yeah, I really appreciate not only Brady's point, but Maxine's point. There is a push-pull. I mean, you can look at an increase in windstorms and be concerned, and we should be, and that's reality for us. You can also say that that is markedly different than entire coastal cities being unlivable anymore. And so it is a different scale of concern and change. And I also want to just flag something. Don't mistake me for a climatologist or a meteorologist, and I want to be careful just because I know not every single weather event, there's a complex set of reasons that cause it. And climate is long-term and weather is next week. But generally, I think the rule of thumb is that extreme weather tends to happen and has become more exacerbated by a changing climate. We have more moisture in the atmosphere. We have more ups and downs in the temperatures. And one of the things that comes to mind for me is a conversation with Professor Laxo at Cornell. I hope I'm remembering this correctly. Professor Alan Laxo told me years ago, don't just think the Finger Lakes is the next Napa when it comes to wine production, because it is likely to become overall a warmer climate than it is now, but it's also likely to be swingier extremes with the weather. So if you're in the winter and you've got a snowpack down on your vines, that's like an insulating blanket that even if it gets pretty cold, that blanket helps. But if you go from 42 degrees one day, no snow on the ground, to -6 the next, those vines could be toast, and all of a sudden that swing exposes the vegetation. It's a real, real problem, and that swingy nature of it complicates the picture. So all of this is complex, and Professor Berger, if you could just follow up on Maxine's point, I do think she is at least reminding us we ought to be thinking about what change does mean for us. What worries you, Professor Berger, about what change could mean in this region?
That's a good question, and thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah.
I think it's important to have humility and sort of expect the unexpected when it comes to climate and how it will unfold in particular locations. I think what worries me the most in our area of the woods is water, because as you say, things are getting stronger, and so most forecasts indicate that we will get more big rainfalls, which can have implications for flooding, but also can have implications for water quality in terms of when they overtax our systems. And so responding to that, I think the most important thing is to make sure that when we're building and improving on infrastructure, it's resilient and can adapt to these large swings that you talk about, that we have droughts, but we also can have these really heavy rainstorms that can tax our systems if we're not prepared for them.
All right. In a moment here, I'm going to get back to your phone calls, but We've just got a long pile of really thoughtful, I think, helpful emails as well. And let me just read a few. Blair says, my wife and I moved to Buffalo in 1990. We immediately noticed a collective inferiority complex among the residents in Western New York. Between the national jokes about the weather here, the economy, the flight of the middle class to places like North Carolina, it was palpable. We found the only people who could appreciate it were those who were from elsewhere. And those who grew up here moved away and then came back by choice. I feel like the malaise has lifted over the past 15 years. It now seems like a vibrant and happier place. That's from Blair. That's a really interesting set of observations. Real quick, Brady, you want to follow that point?
Well, I got to say, I personally never had that inferiority complex, but I was born in 1984, so maybe I was lucky to miss out on that. Although being a Buffalo Bills fan, it has certainly led to some issues, maybe you could say, although that's getting better too. But I'm one of those people who moved away and then came back, and I think there are a lot of good reasons for doing that. And I think now there is, maybe you could say, a turning of the tide and more younger people coming to our area and looking at it for, despite the problems that we certainly have, looking also at all the benefits and the advantages of living here.
Deb says, Rochester gets a bad rap for the total amount of snow we get, but I moved here from Massachusetts, where snow fell in a few 8 to 12-inch storms per year, as opposed to 1 to 2 inches per day for weeks on end. Or where I went to school in Chicago, where it didn't snow much, but I remember having to go to class in negative 20 weather. She says, moved here in 1998 for a few years, and then just has kept forgetting to leave. Well, Deb, we're glad you keep forgetting to leave, and I'm not surprised. I am one of the people who moved to Rochester. Now, I'm from Cleveland, so I mean it's sort of a similar climate, but I moved here thinking in 2002, 2003, thinking, yeah, it'll probably be a few years, and it did not take me long to say, I have no desire to leave. Why would I want to leave? I mean, it's a really lovely community, and it's a great place to be. Robert in Fairport next. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah. I think the weather's gotten less extreme. I mean, I grew up in this area, and back in the late 70s and early 80s, it wasn't unusual to have minus 20 degree nights, 20 degrees below zero. This was in the Finger Lakes region, all right? So you don't see that anymore. I mean, it isn't. You don't get that extreme cold. I'm not aware. I mean, it's even rare to see it even below zero now. So I just don't think it's necessarily – depends on your definition of extreme weather, but certainly extreme cold, it doesn't seem like it's been nearly extreme the past probably 10, 20, 30 years.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, Robert. I mean, Professor Berger, when it comes to extreme cold, and I'll just tell Rob real briefly since we're flying solo today, I can't see my board anymore. It's a great afternoon here on public radio. Professor Berger, to Robert's point, at what point can you look at enough data with weather and say, yeah, I don't think it is extreme cold anymore? Because I'll be honest, I don't know if it was 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I felt like every day in January and February it was 7. I mean, it just felt raw all the time. I take his point that this winter has been considerably milder overall, maybe recent years, but I don't know that I would say it's getting less cold or less extremely cold. How do you see that, Professor?
Yeah, you're right. We did have a year recently when I think we had an entire month where it never got above freezing. We look over multiple years to look at trends when we're talking about climate change, and we certainly see that our average temperatures are increasing. So you have perhaps a greater frequency of milder weather, as he was observing, that we're having at night and even during the day. But that doesn't mean that we don't get these cold spells. And so I think that's where this question of what do we call extreme, if you look at what happened in Texas when the polar vortex went all the way down south and covered most of the country, that was a short-term extreme event, which could be tied in this case to this extreme warming they saw over the North Pole that led to the wobbly polar vortex. So we do see those temporary extremes, but we are having, if you look at the trends over the last decades, you can certainly see that our temperatures are in general increasing, even though there may be short-term cold spells that we that we are very aware of when they happen.
And Professor Brady, are either you aware, Joel in Rochester emails asking if you're aware of any kind of scientific or objective list or ranking of cities across the country as to some sort of likely climate refuge city score, or maybe a ranking of combination of extreme weather threats. I don't know if there's a singular compiled list, though somebody somewhere, I'm sure, has done it. Professor Berger, are you aware?
I'm not aware. I know there was something that there's someone from Harvard who's been talked about Buffalo and has done some comparative rankings, but I'm not aware of a single list. It's a good question.
Yeah, Brady?
Yeah, I have not seen any list, although I have read news and articles mentioning certain places. The Great Lakes as a region being one, I think having that abundant access to that abundant supply of fresh water is a big reason, but I've heard like the Great Lakes and the Northeast, also Vermont, I've seen that come up. Also the Pacific Northwest, excuse me, like Washington State, I've seen that come up as well, but I have not seen a ranked list.
Mm-hmm. A couple more emails, and then we're going to get back to your phones after our only break here. Sue says, Evan, great show. Let's not forget that people who have not caused global warming are often the ones being ravaged with storms, and they cannot survive if they stay in place. And perhaps for them, it's not a slow relocation. She points to the recent story in Guatemala of hurricanes causing mudslides and serious deprivation, loss of life there, and climate refugee status. I take that point too, Sue. I mean, I don't know that we're going to see a city like Rochester double in population in a year or five or even 10, but I certainly take the point that for some communities internationally, this is not a slow building crisis. It's moving more quickly. And we're going to get back to some of your emails and phone calls. Let's take that only break. We're right back with Professor Karen Berger from the University of Rochester, Brady Ferguson, Director of Public Engagement for the Climate Solutions Accelerator of the Genesee Finger Lakes region, and member of Rochester's chapter of the Citizen Climate Lobby. And we'll ask them coming up here, and want you thinking about this as well, if we do see that slow build of movement around the globe and even within this country based on climate, what can our community handle? Are we planning for that? Should public leaders be thinking about it in those terms already? Is that too optimistic? We'll talk about that and more coming up. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about how the pandemic has impacted farms. CSA Day is an annual event. It became CSA Week this year. It just wrapped up. Are you a member of a CSA? Now or in the past? Have you thought about joining? We'll talk about what's out there for CSAs, and we'll talk about how local farms are hanging in there in these unusual circumstances. That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and we're back to your phone calls here. Mike in Walworth. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, Evan, how you doing?
Good, sir.
I've lived in Rochester my whole life, basically. I'm 74, and through business and military, I got to travel all over the world and see lots of different places. And my standard joke when people ask me where I'm from, I'd say Rochester, New York, and they say, wow. And I said, yeah, we have 9 months of winter and 3 months of bad sledding. And I think that this is a great place to live, and I would have a choice to move, but you know, we get the golf season now is late April through November, and you know, it's just a great place, you know, climate wise for a lot of folks, and there are lots of places that you know, you think about Southern California or Arizona. But they all have their drawbacks, and you know, I would rather just be here. It's very moderate and very livable.
Well, I'm with you, and I'm grateful for the phone call, Mike. Thanks for sharing those thoughts. I'm seeing a lot of that via email. Just a lot of feeling of feeling like the rest of the country that is only thinking about Western New York based on reputation is slowly tuning into the fact that, yes, there's snow, and kids actually enjoy it, and we tend to handle it pretty well. Yes, as we've discussed, we need better infrastructure, especially to help people with disabilities and people who are less ambulatory, but hopefully we will work on that. And extreme cold is a problem. There's always an issue of homelessness and shelter. We also tend to see fewer extreme weather events compared to a number of other regions in this country. So I'm with you, Mike, and I appreciate that. Let me get Ted next in Rochester. Go ahead, Ted. Hi, Ted.
Sorry, you there?
We're there. Go ahead, sir. Yep.
Okay, hey. Yeah, thanks, Evan. So, talking about climate change, we're talking about human-created climate change, and that's my assumption, at least. And
yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, our Lake Ontario is surrounded by 8 nuclear reactors, all with nuclear waste at those sites. And whether there's a catastrophic once-in-a-lifetime incident where suddenly nuclear reactors are melting down around our lake, or where sea level rises to a certain level that actually, you know, consumes these, you know, these wasted fuel rods. I'm just wondering, you know, the probabilities are probably very low that anything like that would happen. But if it happens, it's game over. We have a toxic lake and a toxic waterway. And so I'm just wondering if your guests have any thoughts on the nuclearization of the lake and how to denuclearize the lake.
Well, Ted, I appreciate that. And I'll put it in the context of right here, as you mentioned, here in our region, looking at a nuclear reactor near a lake, but also the fact that we have an energy grid that really needs update. I mean, look what happened in Texas. We all know that energy everywhere. The grid needs reworking just about everywhere in this country. We need to reexamine where energy sources are. And to Ted's point, some that are closer to water, should we be concerned about that? Now, my very carefully noted lay opinion or understanding is that ocean rise is maybe more of a concern than lakes, though I don't know. And Professor Berger might jump in here and say, careful, Evan, you're off base there. But how much are we thinking about where the energy sources are? And to Ted's point, Professor Berger, thinking about specifically risks like that.
So I think in terms of worrying about the nuclear plants along Lake Ontario, sea level rise isn't going to affect them because Lake Ontario is at over 200 feet in elevation. In terms of the variability that we see in the lake height, I know people who live along the southern shores of Lake Ontario have in many places been affected by rising sea levels. That is a combination of how the lake is operated in terms of the water being controlled by the dam at the output, and also, or I should say, along the St. Lawrence, and also some amount of precipitation. But we're not going to see more than a few feet potential change in the height of Lake Ontario. And I am confident that the waste that is stored there is not within a few feet of the lake level. So I that is not something I lose sleep about. I can understand why it concerns you, but I would rest assured that that's not going to be a risk for Lake Ontario.
Can I ask both?
I
was just going to follow up and ask both, though, that, you know, when you think about, so that's Rochester, or at least our region here, but when you think about what rising sea levels is going to do to communities, whether it's power sources, as Ted says, or just the infrastructure for communities. Can I ask both of you if you feel like there's enough public discourse, public planning, you know, sort of forward-looking public leadership on this issue? And I'll start with Professor Berger.
I think it really varies depending where you are. I know the city of Boston is putting a tremendous amount of effort and leadership into looking at how they can be more resilient to sea level rise because they have a lot of areas that are really vulnerable to it. If you look at Miami, in contrast, they're talking about it, but there is much less political leadership for the kind of systemic change that they need to make to be resilient. So I think it depends a lot on the particular community.
What do you think, Brady?
Well, I was glad to see that the Buffalo mayor made that statement, but I don't know how much actually action that has been followed up by. And I think overall, our political leaders, and to be honest, all of us, we're not doing enough. We're not being as proactive as we should. Professor Berger mentioned Miami. And in Miami, people are already moving. There's people on the coast who have already moved away a little bit farther inland. Well, what's actually happened in some neighborhoods there is that more wealthy residents who lived on the coast who were able to afford to move somewhere else and buy a new house they're actually moving into neighborhoods that had more low-income people living there, and those neighborhoods are becoming gentrified, and a lot of the people there are being displaced by these wealthier residents moving away from the coast. So that's what I think that's one thing we really have to be careful about, is kind of a double displacement, where people are being displaced from vulnerable areas due to sea level rise, but then they in turn are displacing other residents just for income and reasons related to the price of housing. And that's happening right now in Miami, but who's to say that couldn't happen to Rochester in the future, if the wealthier people who live in more climate vulnerable locations move here to Rochester and then contribute to gentrification in our cities. So that is just one reason among several where our elected leaders, I would really like to see them thinking more about this now and start planning for it.
Well, to your point, Brady, let me take Dave in Brighton on the phone next. Go ahead, Dave.
Oh, Evan, hi. I had sort of, following up on your guest, sort of a mercenary, sheepish question. My family has a home here, and we're always wondering, should we keep it or sell it? And is climate change going to increase the value of older homes here in Rochester, New York? And I know that's not that enlightened question, but that's my question.
Is climate change going to increase the values of homes? And you're not talking about just waterfront homes. You're talking about homes in general.
Yes, homes in general. Yeah. Hold on to old family homes in Rochester that might be being passed down the generations, because this is going to be a hot rental market. I don't like to think of climate change in those kind of mercenary terms, but I'm wondering what your guests think.
Okay. Dave, I appreciate the phone call. Don't ever ask me for economic, financial, housing market advice. You will be only steered wrong. But, Brady, if Dave says it's sort of a mercenary kind of question, and he understands that, but he is curious, do we have an expectation of property values in the future? Brady?
Well, I'm certainly no real estate expert either, but just to connect that to the last point I was making,
yep.
Already in certain parts of the city, like I live in the Swilburg neighborhood, in Swilburg in the South Wedge. On the west side in the 19th Ward and in Plex, we're already seeing some gentrification in those neighborhoods, which is leading to higher home prices. Now, for someone looking to sell their home, that could be a good thing. But for renters who see rents going up and can no longer afford to pay the rent and then have to move or get evicted and go somewhere else, it's not so good a thing. And that's something that we should be concerned about, because more people are going to start moving here because of the impacts of climate change. So that's what I'll say about that.
Okay, Professor Berger?
With the same caveats of not being a realtor, I would also say yes. I think, frankly, we're thinking one of the things we might see in the future is more hot days and longer heat waves. And so especially if your house has air conditioning and some nice natural shading around it, some trees that will help absorb heavy rains that we might get, then it could be well positioned to do well in the future.
Adrian writes and says, I think we should emphasize that it's not that climate change will benefit Rochester. It's that climate change will hurt Rochester less than other regions. I think that's fair. I mean, especially if we're thinking really longer term. And Adrian, when I say longer term, as my friend Adam Frank from the University of Rochester loves to remind us, human beings really think pretty minimalistically when it comes to timescales. We think long-term is the next 10 years. We need to be thinking 100, 200, 1,000, 10,000 years if we're really serious about a long-term planning future for our species on this planet and other species. Because the planet's going to be here. No one needs to worry about saving this planet. This planet will be fine. This planet may simply evict us as possible tenants if we are reckless and it doesn't like what we are doing. But I take that point, Adrian. And so, Professor and Brady, let's just talk a little bit about this here from the local perspective. Professor Berger, I know that the mayor of Rochester or city council or county leadership, they've got enough on their hands, you know, dealing with day-to-day and week-to-week city and county and regional life. I take that point. But if this is going to be a part of the country where more people go, boy, I don't know why I ever had a problem with Rochester, I'm going there, or that seems to be more stable, that's a place to be, then eventually there has to be some significant plans for what that looks like infrastructurally. Or, Professor Berger, do we benefit from the fact that we did used to be a city of 300,000 and, you know, we lost a third of that population? Does that give us at least a head start on the infrastructure to handle this? I mean, how do we start to kind of put those pieces together for planning for the future?
That's a really good question. I think we do benefit that we have the space, as you say, that we had a larger population. I think the place that governments need to start is by looking at where we have existing vulnerabilities to climate change. And I know the city and county are working on that because we want to make sure that the people who are already here are going to be resilient to the changes we expect to see. And then from there, as we evaluate what is protected now, then we can look to expand our infrastructure and other support services so that if we have this gradually increasing population, we can make sure that the housing is robust, the transportation, the education, the other services are robust enough if we do get that rising population into the future. Okay. But it has to start with looking at vulnerabilities right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Brady, what do you think?
Yeah, well, when I think about vulnerability, I think not just about people in our community who may be more vulnerable, but also people in other parts of the country and people around the world. And compassion came up earlier, and I think all of us have at least some level of compassion for other human beings. And considering the injustice of a lot of people around the world who are feeling the most harsh impacts of climate change, and these are the people who contributed least to it, I personally feel like those of us who have contributed more should feel at least some type of responsibility to help others. And my thoughts first go to my family and friends who live in the Republic of Kiribati. That's a place I mentioned before. I used to live there. Very low-lying islands in the Central Pacific Ocean. Mm. And it's likely that in the future they're all going to have to leave their islands because they will no longer be able to live there. And right now there's no immigration pathway for them to go anywhere. But I'm hopeful that in the future there will be. Actually, President Biden, one of his executive orders included a plan to look at migration globally and within the country and the impact of climate change on that. And hopefully they will come out with some meaningful policy that can relate to that. But then bring it back to the local level here. I feel like we can, although maybe the negatives probably do outweigh the positives of climate change here in Rochester, we can still look at it as an opportunity where every year we see it in the news where the New York State population is declining, especially upstate, mm-hmm. and we may even be losing congressional seats. This is an opportunity for us to increase the population, but we have to do it the right way. We have to protect the vulnerable people who are living here. And as far as bringing new people in, we should prioritize the more vulnerable people who really are the ones who need help finding a new place to live. So I know that's a lot, and our local leaders have so many immediate needs they're trying to deal with. But I just hope they can also keep that longer-term vision of how we can build a better future for all of us here.
Keith writes and says, 42 years since we left Denver's two seasons, hot and dry and cold and dry, and the brown cloud for four seasons, and then the clean air here. It's nice to go back there and visit, but here is home. I appreciate that, Keith. And let me also squeeze one more in here. This comes from Bruce, who says, my wife and I came to this area in 2014. She had lived here for many years, and I grew up in Massachusetts, so we were no stranger to winters. We moved here from Albuquerque to be closer to our aging parents. However, my wife has said just what the topic of this show is today. This is a place people are going to move to because of climate change, especially since Rochester has water. Having come from New Mexico, we have a great appreciation for water. That's from Bruce in Fairport. Down to our last 2 minutes, and so my last question for both of you, Professor Berger. We had a couple of emails earlier that I didn't even get to about water commodification and what the future might look like. How much does the access to fresh water here matter? And, you know, whether it's policy or just the reality or even concerns about commodification of water.
As of right now, there is a law that doesn't allow Great Lakes water to be exported out of the Great Lakes basin. So mm-hmm. I think we're sort of protected from the commodification of it outside of the area. But it is something that we're lucky enough to access here. You know, water is interesting in that it's something that can be bought and sold, but also we can't survive without it. And so I think as we move forward, it's important to recognize the values it brings, price it accordingly, but also make sure people have access to it.
Hmm. Brady, what do you think?
Well, when I think about water and how precious of a natural resource it is, I think about Flint, Michigan, and what happened there not so long ago. And there are a lot of places that could happen. I certainly hope not here, but you never know. We have aging infrastructure as well. So I think it is very important that we remember how precious this natural resource is that we have and make sure that we continue to protect it, especially for the most vulnerable people among us.
Brady, you are a director of public engagement for the Climate Solutions Accelerator of the Genesee Finger Lakes region and a member of Rochester's chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby. Where do people learn more about CCL, the Citizens Climate Lobby?
Right, then go to citizensclimate.org. And also, I'll mention that with the Accelerator, we have a big event coming up in April, 22 days of climate justice. And if you go to climategfl.org/climatejustice22days, you can learn more about that event. It's a great way to learn more about climate justice issues in our region and beyond.
You're going to come back to Connections and talk about it?
I'd love to.
Brady, thanks for the time. Always good. Let's talk soon.
Thanks, Evan.
That's Brady Ferguson, Karen Berger, professor at the University of Rochester. Always great to get your insight on this, and Professor, you're generous with your time. Thank you for being with us as well.
Oh, great to be here. Thank you, Evan.
Listeners, just a wonderful stream of thoughtful emails, phone calls. We just have the best listening audience. I'm so grateful for you. Short break and more Connections coming up.